I'll introduce my teacher, Danny Lasker, who probably could sit at the table right here, I suppose, and make him for an intimate gathering, who is the Norbert Blechner Professor of Jewish Values at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Beersheba. His areas of expertise are many, but they tend to coalesce around medieval philosophy, and especially medieval Jewish philosophy, and in particular, applications or the intersection, I guess you could say, of medieval Jewish philosophy and interreligious and intra-religious polemics on the one hand, and Karaism on the other hand. And it's that latter topic that we'll hear taken up in the context of the focus on Tanakh, that is the focus of this Torah in Motion gathering. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to Professor Lasker.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be back in Toronto. Spent a very nice year here over 20 years ago teaching at the University of Toronto. And Professor Lowy was one of my students. And it's always a warm welcome here. In fact, a few years ago as I was crossing the border, the Canadian immigration officer said to me, "How often do you get to Canada?" And since that year was my third visit, but some years, times will go years out coming back, I didn't know how to answer the question, so I was sort of speechless, and I realized later that the correct answer is not as often as I'd like to. But since then, they've never asked me that question again. I'm crossing the border, so I have an answer already. I just don't have the shyla for it. What I wanted to talk to you today is about how interpretation of the Bible can form a community. And this community is the community of the Karaites. And I first formulated some of these ideas in a conference which was in memory of Nachama Leibowitz. Nachama Leibowitz, the great biblical interpreter or teacher of biblical interpretation. I'm sure you all know her books, Iyunim Be, Perspectives On, or whatever it's called in English, the various books. And it says, the subtitle is, Our Earlier and Latter Commentators, Mefarshenu HaAchronim VaRishonim VaAchronim. And I went to look in the index of her books to see which Karaite commentators she mentions. And the truth is, there are none of them that she mentions. In other words, she obviously considered Karaites outside the canon and not part of the Jewish, body politic, people, whatever you'd like to say. And even though occasionally she would have one or two mentioned, they were only because they were mentioned in the rabbinic, the rabbinite commentators. So it's interesting that there's been this feeling among many people in the Jewish studies field and among Jewish perception in general that the Karaites are somehow outside the fold. They're not really Jewish. And what I'd like to show today is that they are a Jewish group with an alternate Judaism, and their alternate Judaism is a function of the way they interpret the Bible. So this could be, you could say, practical application. My university, Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, somehow doesn't know what to do with humanities because they think that the only thing important are those things that have application, science and technology and medicine and engineering. So this is an example where you could say, oh, here we have applied Bible exegesis. It turns out it makes a community. All right, so let's start out with the history of Karaism. When did Karaism begin? Har Sinai. Very good. We have a Karaite representative over here who gave the right answer from the Karaite point of view. The Karaism began at Mount Sinai with the giving of the Torah. And how did that pesky little thing called Rabbinic Judaism, which has all these strange customs, when did that start? When God gave Moshe. So we have now a representative of the Rabbinites. Actually, there is a literature of Rabbinite Karaite jokes. One of the more popular ones is that a Gentile king calls in a representative of the rabbis, are called rabbinites in the context of Karaites, and calls in a Karaite, and the rabbinite representative walks into this debate carrying his shoes, to which point the king says, "Carrying your shoes? How can you carry your shoes?" And the rabbinite said, "Well, when we were at Mount Sinai, God told Moses to take his shoes off. It's a holy place, and that's why we take it off. It's such a distinguished gathering, and the king, take off my shoes." So he says, "Okay, but why are you holding your shoes? Why don't you put them, you know?" He says, "Because when we took off our shoes at Mount Sinai, the Karaites came and they stole our shoes." To which point the Karaites said, "What are you talking about? We weren't there. We weren't even Karaites then." All right? That is a classical rabbinite Jewish joke. Interestingly enough, I've heard this joke transmogrified, if you'd like, into an anti-Palestinian joke, where with the same idea, when Jews came to the land of Israel, whatever, they stole, the Palestinians stole something, and Yair Sarafat, what are you saying? We there were no Palestinians there. So it's interesting how jokes change. Okay, but let's look at historically. Many people, if you ask the story, when is charism from, or what happened to charism, the answer they'll give you is Anan ben David. Nah. See, too much, too sophisticated a group for me. Anan ben David was an 8th century candidate to be exilarch. Now, I have all these great things that resonate with American audiences. I don't know if it'll work north of the border. The theory, the Anan theory, is what I call the disgruntled office seeker theory of the origins of charism. And this expression, this phrase, disgruntled office seeker, I grew up with. It was one of the presidents of the U.S. was assassinated by a disgruntled office seeker. And I also explained south of the border that the exilarch was equivalent to being the chairman of the council of presidents of major Jewish organizations. But it wasn't quite that. It was the civil head of the Jewish community in Babylonia. And this Anan was a candidate, supposedly, but the rabbis were suspicious. They chose his brother Hananiah, his younger brother. Anan was angry. He set up his own exilarchate. The caliph had heard about this, and the caliph had confirmed the appointment of the brother, so he was angry, and he puts Anan in jail. Anan in jail meets up with a Muslim, and they're saying, "You know, what are you in for? What are you in for?" And Anan explains the story. So the Muslim The Muslim cellmate, who was later identified in Jewish, in some sources, Abu Hanifa, the head of the Hanafite school of Muslim jurisprudence, who himself was executed in 767, which gives us a date for Anan. Anyway, says to him, "Why don't you convince the caliph that basically you're a different religion than your brother? I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that, and that your religion is closer to Islam, and this is how what happens, and that's how charism is born." And this explanation is a good example of traditional rabbinite rabbinic historiography, that there's one Torah from Sinai all the way down to the Messiah, and that anybody who left in the middle did for bad reasons. Like, for instance, the Sadducees or the Boethians. Why did Tzadok and Baitus, why did they leave the fold? Because they didn't listen to their teachers correctly. Their teacher Antigonos Isocho said, "Don't be like the servant who serves the master to get reward. Be like a servant who does it not to get reward." And they didn't listen too carefully. And they said, "Oh, it means there is no reward and punishment," and they left the fold. Or Shabtai Tzvi, or you can even take it to our own day, depending on who's telling the story. Zionism is leaving the fold of Judaism. Reform is leaving the fold of Judaism, but always for a bad reason. And there's one line from Sinai down to Messiah. But that's not the Karaite narrative. The Karaite narrative is, as Professor Lowry suggested, that charism began on Mount Sinai when God gave Moses the one Torah. Not two Torahs, one Torah, the oral Torah. And the written Torah, I'm sorry, the one written Torah. And based on a story in the Gemara about the persecution, Alexander Yanai persecuted the scholars. Basically what happened is that he was the Hasmonean king, and the Hasmonaim, as you all know, are Kohanim. Right? So the Cheshbonaim were high priests. He wanted to be a high priest. There was a little question about his mother and whatever. They said to him, you know, being king is really good enough. Why don't you let somebody else be high priest? And he didn't like this very much. And he asked his friends, what should he do? And they said, well, you know, why don't you kill all these guys? So he said, well, if I kill all the scholars, who's going to teach Torah? So they said, what do you need that for? You have the written Torah. That's all you need. So he killed all the scholars. Two guys escaped. One was Yehuda ben Tabai, and then was Shimon ben Shetach. Shimon ben Shetach goes down to Egypt, makes up a new religion, comes back to Israel. And even in those times, he had what was called protexia. What was his protexia? His sister was queen. All right, actually, we say in Israel that if you know the right people, you don't really need protexia. So he knew the right person. And since the only other person around was Yehuda ben Tabai, the loyalist, according to the Karaite narrative, Shimon ben Shetach, with his connections, wins the day. And from then on, you have this newfangled religion of the Pharisees, of the Oral Torah, the idea of an Oral Torah. I don't want to go into too far into it because I want to discuss the issues of the Bible, but there, in the last 50, now it's almost 60 years since the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's more and more people who think that the Karaites do have a Second Temple origin. And the question of Karaite origins is still very difficult to determine. One thing is clear, that Anan was not a Karaite. Anan founded a group called the Ananites, and even though their influence, some of his rulings influenced the later Karaites, and they adopted him, he really was not a Karaite. And for a couple hundred years, there was a distinction between Karaites and Ananites. However, Anan is known for a number of things, which I'll just mention. One of them, in this context of this day, is his so-called slogan. His slogan was Chapisu Bo'oraita Shapir, Ba'al Tishanu Al Da'ati, which means search scriptures well and don't rely on my opinion. It doesn't really reflect what he believed, and we're not sure he even said it, but it at least is a sort of popular imagination that Karaites is searching scripture well. Chapisu Bo'oraita Shapir. One of the reasons people doubt that it's really his slogan or that it's authentic is that the slogan is in two different languages. The first one is Aramaic, Chapisu Bo'oraita Shapir, and the other one is in Hebrew, Bal Tishanu Al Da'ati, don't rely on my opinion. My take on it is that religious slogans can be in different languages, the same slogan, such as Anachnu Rotzim Moshiach Now. So that's a few different languages. And but Anan is not charism. Yesterday, on the Shabbos table, was pointed out that one of the Ananite reference, one of his part of his halacha, came from yesterday's portion about not leaving the house on the Sabbath. And indeed, Anan said, except for going to the synagogue, one should not leave one's house on the Sabbath. But that was not adopted by later Karaites. Another thing in yesterday's parsha was the statement that God says, if you observe the commandments, then I will not bring upon you all the illnesses of Egypt. Ki ani Hashem rofecha, I am Lord your God, I am your doctor. Well, according to a later account, Anan, on the basis of this verse, said one should not seek medical attention. And I'm not even sure that that's true about Anan or the Ananites. But it's certainly not true for the Karaites. But if you open up almost every book on Jewish medical ethics, the introduction will be a comparison about the stupid Karaites who don't let you go to a doctor and the smart rabbinites who say, yes, rapo yirapeh, and that there's commandment to heal, etc. But this idea that Karaites don't go to doctors all goes back to this Anan. And certainly Aaron ben Yosef Harofe, the 13th century Karaite authority, who Harofe means the doctor, he certainly believed in medicine. Kir Kasani, the 10th century great Karaite legalist and commentator, refuted this supposed Anan statement. And so it's really the idea that Anan is charism is really a mistaken idea. And even though both Karaites and Rabbinites look to him as being important in the history of Karaism, it's really sort of mistaken. Karaites are always part of the Jewish body politic. And I know, with a perspective, I assume most people here have an Ashkenazic background, and most people here live in the 21st century. I'm the only one. I'm the only 12th century person here, right? No, you're in the Harrison, 15th century. Most people here are probably 21st century. With that perspective, after 200 years or so that the Karaites in Eastern Europe tried to avoid being identified with being Jewish, and they did it for political reasons in order to not have the Jewish disabilities in Tsarist Russia, and then again during the Holocaust. So people with that background are used to thinking of Karaites as not part of the Jewish community. But certainly in many places in Jewish communities, the Karaites were part and parcel, especially the Egyptian community. We know from the Geniza that Karaites and Rabbinites married with each other. They had prenuptial agreements. Whose holidays would they follow? Whose dietary laws? Whose marital purity laws would they follow? So they'd have these two boats where they'd outline the what the agreements would be. And even to this very day, in 1955, there were two Egyptian Jews who were executed for spying or provoking for Israel, a Lavon affair. One of them was Moshe Marzouk, was a Karaite. And the Karaites in Israel today, of which there are maybe somewhere between 20 and 25,000, it's hard to tell, are certainly part of the Jewish community, and perhaps I'll talk about them a little bit later. The thing with Karaite biblical exegesis is that it's very important for them, but again, unlike what most people think, they are not literalists. The idea that Karaites take the Bible literally is untrue for, among other reasons, it's impossible to take the Bible literally. And the name Karaite from B'nai Mikra or Karaim seems to be from the word Mikra, from Scripture. So there is this idea they're scripturalists. When the Protestants discovered them in the 16th, 17th century, they said, oh, they're the Jewish Protestants, sola scriptura, only the Scripture. But of course, that's not true. Now, they do deny the oral Torah, the Torah Sheba'al Peh, but they don't deny that one has to interpret the Bible. And this is what I'll talk about today. Just an example, and I'll come back to this example later. Let's take the calendar. What does the Torah tell us about the calendar? How to make the Jewish calendar? Very little. Like, almost nothing. HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. This month to you will be the first month. Which month? What do you mean, this month? I mean, the rabbis say that God took Moses out and showed him the new moon and said, you know, this month, look at this, Rei Zeh V'Chadesh. This is what the Kadesh, you make this holy. But it doesn't tell us, is it a solar calendar, is it a lunar calendar, is it a lunisolar calendar? We don't know. And in the Second Temple, there are various different calendars floating around. And as Ibn Ezra reports, I mean, Ibn Ezra says it very nicely. He says, the Torah gives exact laws for people who have leprosy. Tzarad, it's not really leprosy, but people have leprosy. Now, how many people get leprosy?
Very few.
How often do they get it? Even then. How often, tzarad, it's talking about. How many people get it? Almost no one. How often? Almost never. And what does the Torah tell us? All the laws, how to deal with it. How often does one need to know what the day is in the Jewish calendar?
Every day.
And how many Jews need to know it? Every Jew. What does the Torah tell us? Nothing. So, obviously, one cannot live by the Torah literally. And indeed, in some respects, the Rabbinites take verses literally, and the Karaites take them allegorically. I'll also give some examples. So they have their own methods of interpretation, mostly based on logical analogy, called Hekesh. They have tradition, they call in Hebrew Sevel HaYerusha or HaTaka. They have their own terms for tradition. What they claim is that their tradition is not from Sinai and doesn't contradict what's in the Torah. So what I wanted to do is give a few examples of how the Karaites read the Torah and the Bible in general and how that forms them into a separate group. So one last item of introduction in the sense, when I say a separate group, if you want to be a separate Jewish group, how do you go about doing it? Or let's put it a different way. What makes a Jewish group separate from other Jewish groups? Well, it could be differences in theology. Right? You could have one group that believes God gave the Torah to Moses, or two Torahs to Moses on Mount Sinai. You could have other people say, well, the Torah is a later development. You could have people believe in a personal God who watches over us, and you can have a belief in a God who's the power to make good in the world. I mean, you could have differences in theology. You could have different socioeconomic status. You could have one group of Jews who say, you know, I belong to this country club, and this group of Jews who don't belong to any country club. I mean, that's a little bit perhaps extreme, but there are those who actually interpret Karaite origins as being a socioeconomic thing. You have different ethnic origins. We have Jews from Ethiopia. We have Jews from Romania. We have Jews from Canada. We have Jews from Lithuania, etc. Or one could have a different way of life. And that would mean it's a different halacha, different law. So let's look at these points just for a minute. Karaites and theology. Karaite theology is almost not at all different from rabbinic theology. What I like to point out is that Maimonides has how many articles of faith? 13. How many do Karaites believe in? 12.5. Right? Which is the half they don't believe in? Oral Torah. Torah Shabbat. Otherwise, they take all the other 13 principles. Socioeconomic differences, as I said, some people try to say there's it, but you have rich Karaites and poor Karaites, you have rich Rabbinites and poor Rabbinites, you have educated Karaites and educated Rabbinites, non-educated ones, so that's not the difference. Ethnic origins, well, you have Egyptian Rabbinites, Egyptian Karaites, Babylonian Karaites, Babylonian Rabbinites, etc. So the real difference is practice, and that is the result of biblical exegesis. So I'm going to give four examples. Food, calendar, prayer, and personal status. Now, there are different interpretations of other things, such as, let's say, torts and damages. But given the fact that when charism develops as charism, neither the Karaites or the Rabbinites are really judging issues of personal damage or monetary events. So it doesn't really matter in terms of a different community whether or not they interpret the laws of watchmen the same way or differently. All right, let's start out with food. What are the rabbinic dietary laws with which we're all familiar? Well, Jews don't eat impure animals, tameot. What kind of animals are those? Pigs, camels, rabbits, okay. Or animals who've died on their own, that's in the Nevelah. Or animals which have not been slaughtered ritually or killed by hunting or something, that's trefot. Ritual slaughter is with a blessing, and done in a manner to reduce the suffering and also to get rid of much of the blood as possible. No eating the remaining blood that's salted to get rid of it and washed. Check the health of the animal. Certain parts of the animals aren't eaten, the sciatic nerve, the gita nashe, and the certain fats. And what's the biggie one after all those? Basar b'chalav, meat and milk. Rabbinic Jews do not eat milk and meat together. Now, some of these prohibitions are found in specific verses, such as the particular animals or the sciatic nerves or the fats, prohibition of blood. But other aspects are not in specific verses, such as even how one slaughters. We don't know from the Bible how one's supposed to slaughter. How one checks the animal. Again, no indication, a blessing. There are no blessings mentioned in the Bible. And there's one other aspect which comes from the verse, but the verse is perhaps a little bit unclear. And what's the verse? You shall not cook a kid in its mother's milk. Do not see the kid in its mother's milk. And that's the prohibition, the source, the prohibition of milk and meat. Now, we look at the Karaites. We see the Karaites don't eat tameot, these impure animals. They don't eat nevelot, the ones who died of their own. They don't eat trefot, the ones who weren't slaughtered ritually. They prohibit the sciatic nerve and certain fats, but they do it in a certain different way than the rabbinites. And one of the major issues throughout rabbinite Karaite history is the permissibility of the fat tail. That's called the ayala, the alya, rather, the alya, the fat tail. I don't know what, I assume it's somewhere in the back of the animal, but we Rabbinites eat it, Karaites don't eat it. But they slaughter animals, even though there's no verse about it. They make a blessing, but slightly different blessing, blessing God for permitting slaughter rather than first commanding slaughter. Checking is done a little bit differently. But what's the major difference? The major difference is meat and milk. Karaites have no separate utensils, have no separate sinks and counters. They don't wait between eating milk and meat. There's no prohibition of cooking them together or deriving benefit from them. Last week I gave a talk. I would assume most people were Jewishly knowledgeable, but perhaps probably secular. So I was trying to explain to them the difference between normal people and like someone like me. Like normal people have one set of dishes, and maybe if they're fancy, they'll have a set for good. And I have milchig every day, milchig Shabbos, fleishig every day, fleishig Shabbos, Pesach milchig, Pesach Shabbos, sabbatical milchig, sabbatical fleishig, sabbatical Pesach milchig, sabbatical Pesach. I mean, they don't have to do all that. Oh. In the basement. All right. All right. What's the rabbinic prohibition? Yes? Well, the three verses are Exodus 23:19, 34:26, and Deuteronomy 14:21. Anybody wants to check it? I have a Bible here. Lo tavashel gedi b'chalev imo. Do not cook a goat in its mother's milk. Well, Anan, not only did he not say there's no blanket prohibition, but he says we're not even dealing with milk and meat altogether. By the way, I use Anan also forbid the use of chicken. So I often point that out as a point against them when talking about the Judaism of Karaites. They don't drink, at least Anan, they do, but Anan didn't have chicken soup. But the countervailing argument is the Kirkasani, who I mentioned in the 10th century, who said no two Karaites agreed about anything and it gets worse from day to day. So I use that as point out their Jewish identification. Anyway, what Anan seemed to say, and notice how this is not going to be literal, that Gedi has to do with the first fruits. And the word is not Gedi, goat, but Meged, like in fruit or produce. And we can't let the first fruits, he said, ripen to Vashel, like in Lahavshil, in the field on the tree, which is the milk of its mother. Rather, we have to bring the first fruits to the temple quickly. So it has nothing to do with milk and meat altogether, let alone a prohibition of eating them together. And why did he say it has to do with the first fruits? Because if you look at the two verses in Exodus, the end of the verse is, Lot Vashel Gediva Chalevi Mo, don't cook a goat in its mother's milk. But the beginning of the Pasuk is, Reishit Bikriyat Matecha Tavi Beit Adonai Elohecha, the first fruits bring to the temple, Lot Vashel Gediva Chalevi Mo, don't hesitate, don't wait for it. Well, Karaites did not accept this interpretation. They also thought it was somewhat off the wall. And Ibn Ezra, in his commentary in Exodus 23, says, thoughtless people, chesrei dat, maybe means idiots, say the gedi is derived from meged, this fruit or produce. That is impossible. The mem of the word meged is part of the root, as we see in the verse from Shir HaShirim, Pri Megadim, with choicest fruits. And he says one doesn't find such usage in the holy language, in Hebrew. I mean, it doesn't make sense. Gedi is a fruit. And what is lo tivashel? Don't cook. No one knows it's tivashel for ripen. People don't cause the fruit to ripen. And chalev imo, the milk, who says that's, whoever talks about the fruit being growing on the tree as being the fruit being on the mother. So when is the tree ever called the mother of the fruit? Interestingly enough, if you look at Aaron ben Elijah, the 14th century Karaite commentator, he cites Ibn Ezra's comment almost word for word. He just left out two words, chesrei dat, the idiots. I mean, he knew about whom Ibn Ezra was talking about. But Aaron didn't accept Anan's exegesis, and all the Karaites. They said Anan was not a Karaite. And the Karaites accept that Gedi b'chalev imo means has to do with a goat. How do they interpret the verse, do not cook a goat in its mother's milk? Don't cook a goat in its mother's milk. Very, very radical explanation. Okay? Now, even they have expansions. So, for instance, you can't cook a mother goat in its daughter's milk. And you can't cook a calf in its mother's milk. But if you have, I mean, the example I would use in Israel today, if you have meat imported from Argentina and your milk milked in Kibbutz Chafetz Chaim or someplace, all right, the possibility that they'd be the same mother and daughter is not at all possible. But still, just to make sure, they wanted to have the same meal, have milk and meat from the same species. So they could have mutton, for instance, with cow milk. And certainly fowl, which was rabbinic practice in the Galil until the Judeans and the Babylonians took over and prohibited that. So there's no blanket prohibition, there's no separate dishes, and because of the different way of understanding this biblical verse, the whole idea of Karaite kashrut is different than Rabbinite kashrut. I mentioned calendar. As I said, we don't know how the original calendar was made, and how do we determine it? We have in the Mishnah, we have the explanation of how witnesses would come to witness the new moon. And also, we learn from the Talmud that one of the reasons to make a leap year is if the barley had not yet ripened, the Aviv. Because the Shmort Chodesh Aviv observed the month of the new barley. This is the Aviv. Well, Rabbinites overcame this because they figured it's too difficult to rely on witnesses and exile, whatever. So they started a calculated calendar, and the calendar we have today is calculated. You can work out a calendar for 6,000 years just on the basis of mathematics. But the Karaites said that it should be actually calculated, see the new moon, and then you start the new moon, see the Aviv, and then you don't have a leap year. And in fact, the Muslims to this day theoretically rely on observation. And this is supposedly why the Karaites were a little bit closer to the Muslims. But today, the Karaites themselves have a calculated calendar, and there's a group of dissident Karaites or neo-Karaites who 2 years ago, when it was a leap year, went out during the month of Adar, the first month of Adar, found the Aviv, the barley, and said, no, we're not making a leap year this year. And there's something Karaites fight about, to this day, fight about calendar. But what's the big difference in the calendars? A lot of it has to do with the verse in Leviticus 23:4. These are the appointed seasons, appointed feasts of the Lord, the holy convocations, which you shall claim at their appointed times. Well, it says, Asher tikru'u otam b'mo'adam, but the word otam, them, is written without the vav. So if you just saw the word, if you showed it to an Israeli today, Aleph Tetaf Mem, what would they say? Atem. That you shall declare. And the rabbis say this means that the Beit Din has to proclaim them. But not only does it depend upon the court, but even though it says in their appointed seasons, b'mo'adam, there are some exceptions. And again, I assume everyone here, almost everyone here knows that Rosh Hashanah does not fall on certain days of the week, which are Adu, Sunday, Wednesday, Friday. Why does Rosh Hashanah not fall on Sunday, Wednesday, or Friday? Well, if it fell on Wednesday, Yom Kippur would be on Friday, which meant Yom Kippur and then Shabbat, very inconvenient. If Rosh Hashanah fell on Friday, Yom Kippur would be on Sunday. You'd have Shabbat, then Yom Kippur, very difficult. And why not on Sunday? Because then Hashanah Rabbah would be on a Saturday, and then you couldn't slug your shyness, you wouldn't hit your willow branches. So, you don't have Rosh Hashanah on Adu, which means you don't have Pesach on Badu on Monday, Wednesday, or Friday, etc. What do the Karaites say? The Karaites say, the verse says, these are the holy days of the Lord, which Shetigrotam Mimo Adam, which you shall have in their appointed seasons, period. It doesn't continue and say, which you shall have in your appointed seasons, unless it's inconvenient for you. The rabbis basically say, if it's inconvenient, you know, Shabbos, then Yom Kippur, then Shabbos. Okay. Isn't easy, but, you know, who says, you know, Shveretz Zayin Yid? It's difficult being Jewish, but, so therefore they don't have these postponements. Any holiday can fall on any day, except one holiday, which is going to be always on Sunday, which is Shavuot. Why? Because it says in Leviticus 23:15, "Usfartim lachem imocharat haShabbat." You start counting from the day after Shabbat. Well, how do the rabbis interpret that? The day after the first day of Pesach, the day after the holiday of Pesach. All right? What do the Karaites say? And this goes to Sadducees and other groups. Svartim lechem imochrat haShabbat means start counting on Sunday. And on the morrow of the seventh Sabbath means on a Sunday. So the Shavuot in the Karaite calendar is always on Sunday. In the Rabbinite calendar, it's always on the sixth of Sivan. They also have different fast days, the seventh of Tammuz, the seventh and tenth of Av. And calendar actually has always been a very good way of causing schism. If one of the ways you want to express your own individuality as a group is to have a different calendar than the other group. Going back to Jeroboam. Do you remember Jeroboam decided instead of going to making Sukkot in the seventh month in Jerusalem, he'd keep people in the northern kingdom of Israel and observe Sukkot in the eighth month. So that was schismatic 3,000 years ago, and it's a great way of making schism to this very day. All right, what about prayer? What does it tell us in the Bible about prayer? Excuse me? Very little. Again, very little. Well, the Karaites say that there were, the verse in 1 Chronicles 23:30 says, and they shall stand every morning thanking and praising the Lord, and likewise at evening. So when do you thank and praise the Lord? Morning and evening. When do you have the two sacrifices during the day? Morning and evening. How many times a day should you pray? Twice. What do the rabbinites say? Psalms 55:18. Evening and morning and at noon I utter my complaint and moan and he will hear my voice. And Daniel 6:11. He got down upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God. So, rabbinites say three times a day, Karaites say twice a day. And even the form of prayer is much different. The Karaites' original prayer, at least, was mostly biblical verses, only biblical verses, mostly from Psalms. The prayer books are different. The synagogues are different. Karaite synagogue has no chairs and has carpets, has no shoes. They practice full prostration. Karaites take different verses in the Bible describing bowing down as indication that one bows down, such as Psalm 95:6, let us worship and bow down, let us kneel before the Lord, our Maker. Now, many are familiar that in Rabbinite prayer, on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, there is full prostration, but that's once on Rosh Hashanah and four times in Yom Kippur and then in Musaf. But originally, that was the Rabbinite, the Jewish form of prayer was full prostration. What was one of the miracles in the Beit HaMikdash? That no matter how crowded they were, there's always plenty of room to spread out and bow down. So that was originally part of Jewish prayer. And they said, you know, why change it? That's the way it should be. Also, no tefillin. I once read that, you know, usually when you say tefillin, you then explain phylacteries. And someone, I read someplace, the person's never met anybody who knew what phylacteries were who didn't know what tefillin were. So anyway, tefillin, they don't wear. Or a mezuzah, and they said that when you should bind a sign upon your hands, it means that that's the Ten Commandments because of the ten fingers. Or frontlets between your eyes, it's metaphorically, you should keep them in mind. Doorposts upon your house and your gates means you should always have these words with you when you come and go. Which shows us the Karaites here are being figurative. The Rabbinites are being very literal. They say, bind it on your hands. Well, you got to bind it on your hands. Put it on the doorposts? Got to put it on the doorposts. Etc. And one more example, personal status. The Torah prohibits certain levels of incest. It has a list of forbidden relations in Leviticus 18 and 20. One of those prohibitions is that it's forbidden for a man to marry his brother's wife, or have sexual relations with them, to marry a brother's wife. But if we look at Deuteronomy 25, 5 to 10, there's a description of what's called Levirate marriage. Again, I don't know how many people know what Levirate marriage is, don't know what Yibum is. All right? Yibum means marrying the widowed wife of a brother who had no children. Well, in Leviticus it says you're forbidden to marry your brother's wife. In Deuteronomy it says you're commanded to marry your brother's wife. So the rabbis say, well, when there are children, you're forbidden. When there are no children, your commander. The Karaites say, no, this doesn't refer to a literal brother in Deuteronomy. It means a relative has to do this Yibum. The Torah prohibits an aunt from marrying a nephew. Right? an aunt. You're not, a man is not to have relations with his father's sister. That's an aunt and a nephew. What about an uncle with a niece? Torah doesn't say it. What do the rabbis say? It's allowed. Not only is it allowed, it's actually a good idea, the rabbis think. Right? Maybe, I don't know, you know, if they're thinking multi-generational aunts and uncles or same generation, I mean, uncles and nieces. There's a story about a poor girl who goes to school one day, high school, Haredi most likely, when the high school, the teacher says, "Why weren't you in school yesterday?" "I'm really very sorry, but my mother was giving birth and I had to babysit for my aunts and uncles." So anyway, so uncle-niece marriage is allowed in rabbinic literature and law, but Karaites say no, that you learn through logical analogy. And there are other differences between the laws of incest, interpretation of the incest. On the other hand, the Rabbanites don't accept Karaite marriage laws because, in general, they accept that the Karaite marriages were legitimate. But if they got a divorce, since they didn't get a Rabbanite get, if the woman were to remarry, there'd be a question of mamzerut, the status of unmarriageability, the child, a product of an incestuous or adulterous relationship. So there is an issue of intermarriage. And despite that, there always was. And even to this day, there's a difference between Ashkenazi and Sephardim post-scheme as to whether or not to allow intermarriage between Rabbanites and Karaites. Unsurprisingly, Ashkenazim say no, and Sephardim say yes. But it's not only an Ashkenazi, Sephardi, liberal, strict interpretation. Also, it's because in Sephardi lands, such as Egypt, the Karaites were always part of the community, whereas as in Ashkenazic countries, such as in Eastern Europe, and Lithuania, and Poland, the Karaites were really very separate. So it made sense that the prohibition. It's also of interest that the responsum that allows intermarriage between Karaites and Rabbanites was given by the 16th century rabbi, Egyptian rabbi, the Radbaz, Rabbi David ben Ibn Abu Zimra. And his legal thinking was that since the Karaites and the Rabbanites were so far away in their communities, when the Karaites had a wedding, there were undoubtedly no kosher witnesses there because none of the Karaites would be kosher witnesses. Therefore, the wedding is not a wedding. Therefore, they don't need a divorce. Therefore, a second marriage is permissible. Some of you may recognize this tshuva because it has resonance in the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein about reform marriage. And it was also adopted in the cases by Sephardim, Rav Yehuda Yosef, in the case of Ethiopians. The same issue. Ethiopians got married, even though they're Jewish, according to this tshuva. Their marriages were not really marriages because there are no kosher witnesses. Therefore, they didn't need divorces. Therefore, there's no question of mamzerut. Therefore, there's no problem of remarriage. Just a personal aside, I have a feeling that the Radbaz knew that the communities in Egypt were much closer than he described them. And in fact, the reason he had to come up with this ruling is because they were marrying with each other, right? So that it's not a question of separate communities the way he describes. But my son-in-law tells me that no posek would intentionally distort the truth, and therefore he couldn't know anything. Thank you very much. People always ask me what's the case in Israel today, and indeed there is intermarriage, and generally the Karaites know when there's a mixed Karaite Rabbanite couple, they know to which rabbinate to go, which will perform the wedding. And I just recently came to me a new graduate student who is the great-great-grandson of Abraham Firkovich, the collector of manuscripts, the Karaite collector of manuscripts in the 19th century. And excuse me? Yeah, there are people who question his bona fides. And his grandparents already, his grandfather was the Firkovich, but his grandmother was not. He described him as a secular Karaite who married a secular Rabbanite, but they married in Switzerland. The Rabbanites there got permission from Rabbanite in Israel, and here's a guy, the grandson, who served in the Nahal Haredi, and when his father-in-law, whom I went to the university 30 years ago with, said to me, how many Karaites are there? I said, well, the question is, who's a Karaite? I said, is he a Karaite? So the Sperkovich great-great-grandson said, Chas v'Sholom, you know, I'm not a Karaite. So when people ask me how many Karaites there are, the first thing I always say is, who is a Karaite? You know, tell me how to define a Karaite, then we'll start counting. So in Israel today, the Karaites have de facto recognition to run their own affairs, but de jure they don't. In other words, they're not recognized by the law, but the Karaites have their own courts and their own marriages and divorce. And another thing of interest, there are no agunot, there are no women who are left without divorces in Karaites, because in Karaism, because the Karaite court can issue a divorce if the husband refuses or can't be found. The Karaite court can issue it in his name, and there are no problems of chained women in Karaite. Well, you know, the husband also gives the wife something of value, but can do it through a shaliach, can give it through a representative. So that, so what you're saying is that they're being non-literal and the rabbis are being literal. Yes. So, but they decide that the court can be the representative of the person, whether he likes it. No, it's not mafkia kiddushin. It's giving the divorce, issuing a divorce despite the fact that the husband doesn't want. There are a few other examples, the observance of the Sabbath. Until the 15th century, the Karaites would sit in darkness, and in the 15th century, they allowed lighting candles before Shabbat without a blessing, but at least there would be light in the house on Friday night. But no heating in the house, no hot food, no cholent. There's so many different varieties. I'm sure the Karaites in Lithuania had to have some sort of arrangement for heating their house on the Sabbath and holidays. Right. Someone tells me being in the Troki Karaite community restaurant on Shabbat and was being served the Karaite delicacy of cholent. So, I mean, when I talk about charism, I usually talk about classical charism. Of course, when I talk about rabbinite Judaism, I usually talk about classical rabbinite Judaism also. Anyway, all these examples show that many of the differences between the groups have their origin in different exegesis of the Bible. So you have each community in its own exegesis, each community in its own halacha. And I think this example shows the centrality of the Bible for the Jewish people and as a source of Jewish unity. David Ben-Gurion, as many of you know, was a great admirer of the Bible. He didn't observe any of it. He didn't practice it. He didn't take it seriously as revealed law, but he did have a great respect for the Bible. And this sort of early Zionist love of the Bible as a substitution for halacha, substitution of Judaism, substitution of Jewish tradition, has basically disappeared among secular Israelis today, because they inherited from their parents the antagonism to traditional Judaism, but they did not inherit from their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents this love of the Bible. Interestingly enough, in the case that I talked about today, the Bible is a source of separation and sectarianism, and I think that's also part of the tapestry of Judaism. So, anyway, thank you very much. And
okay, we're going to have a brief question period. Eric's going to bring the mic around. And
if the Karaites disregarded Torah Shebaal Peh, where would they have come to laws of Shechita from?
All right, the question was, where do they have the laws of slaughtering if they don't have the oral Torah? Well, one way of saying it is that certain things are so ingrained in the Jewish community that when the Karaites broke away, they took with them certain things which were sort of self-understandable, self-explanatory. And that's one possibility. Another possibility is that it does refer to the slaughtering of sacrifices. So that even though there's no instructions how to slaughter, and whether it's from the front of the neck, the back of the neck, there was a tradition in Judaism of the slaughtering. Also the prohibition of eating blood. One of the ways of getting blood is physiologically true, that you do the neck, you get rid of as much blood as possible. So a lot of the things they have were either picked up or were just remnants of when Judaism was more united, but I'm not sure there was ever a point when Judaism was more united. I'll give you another example. Karaites and Rabbanites have no disagreements whatsoever about the text of the Bible. All groups use the Masoretic text, which might indicate that the schism was after the text was already established. It might indicate, some people think the Masoretes were Karaites themselves, but then why would the Rabbanites accept their work? Or it was just one of these things which was joined for all Jews. So the differences, there are ritual differences which are significant, but there are certain what unites the groups are certainly much greater than what divides them. So shechita, slaughter, would be, I think, one example.
Let us assume that you're in an area you want to, where you don't find a synagogue except the Karaite synagogue. Would you enter? Any problems?
Is a Rabbinite Jew allowed to enter a Karaite synagogue? Is that the question? I suggest you ask the rabbi. I will, however, tell you the first time I went into the Karaite synagogue was on Shavuot. It was their Shavuot. It wasn't my Shavuot. And there were, first of all, they hurried over to bring me a chair. I said, wait, you're not allowed. He says, well, would you rather sit on the floor? I said, okay, fine, I'll sit in the chair. I did have to take off my shoes. The Reform Karaite. Well, some of them were taking out the money to give the contributions. There were many old people, like almost no young people. The president apologized for me that there was low attendance because it was a work day and some of the soldiers had to go back to the army and some of the people had to go, children had tests and whatever. It sounded, for someone growing up in America, sounded like very familiar. And this is one of the problems of contemporary charism in Israel, that the assimilation is not to Christianity or to some other religion, but assimilation is to Israeliness, Israeli secularness, or even Israeli religious. I mean, there are Karaites who have adopted rabbinic Judaism, because it's not like, the example I give is in America, the kid says, I want a Christmas tree. What do you say to him? You say, well, Christmas isn't our holiday, right? A Karaite kid wants to have a Hanukkah menorah, because Hanukkah is a post-biblical holiday. It's not the Karaite halacha. And what do you say to the kid? Oh, I'm sorry, that's not a Jewish holiday. I mean, it's not a Karaite holiday, but it's a national Israeli holiday. So there are stories of Karaites who actually do light candles without blessing on Hanukkah because, excuse me? The Murano Karaite. Yeah, so it's very difficult. And so the Karaite synagogues are much different in terms of they're set up, as I said, no chairs. They do full prostration. They have carpets on the ground, etc. So to get back to your question, it's permissible to enter into a Karaite synagogue. I suggest you ask a rabbi, and if you want further information, I can tell you about my visits to cathedrals. Yeah. Women, very good question. Separate section, and forbidden to enter during menstrual impurity. Menstrual impurity, however, lasts normally just 7 days and is taken away by washing rather than by immersion in a mikveh. So there's no Karaite mikveh, and the biblical prohibition of separation generally in most cases be over after 7 days, and so with washing. The Rambam has a tshuva attacking such practices among Rabbinite Jews in Egypt. And also, on the other hand, the Karaites practice 40-day separation after birth of a son and 80-day separation after birth of a girl, which is not the Rabbinite practice.
At the beginning of your talk, I got the impression that the Karaite tradition really started at the Second Temple. Now, is there any written records that we have what happened, let's say, between the 1st and 8th century when some people claim Anan started? Is there any Karaite records that we could refer to?
Okay. That's a great question. What happened is that the Rabbanites were saying Anan started it in the 8th century. The Karaites were saying, no, we always were, and we go back Second Temple, or Second Temple is when the Rabbanites broke off, and there's a group in the Second Temple called the Tzadikim, not the Tzidukim, but the Tzadikim, who basically, they didn't say it this way, but had Tzidukim, Sadusi Halacha, and Prushi, Pharisaic theology, more or less. What did the Rabbanites say? Ha, 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 there is no such group as that. 1897, Salman Schechter gets to Cairo. He does discover the Geniza. He already knew about the Geniza, but he takes back the Geniza. And he discovers a manuscript of a group, which he called a Zadokite fragment. And it had a description of halakha of some group, which sort of sounded like Karaites, but not exactly. And Louis Ginsberg, Levi Ginsberg, his colleague of Jewish Theological Seminary, wrote a book in German called Ein unbekannte jüdische Sekt, an unknown Jewish sect, about the group of this people, and compared it with Sadducean law, Pharisaic law, whatever. So there's still no proof. 1947, a Bedouin finds the Dead Sea Scrolls, and what should be in the Dead Sea Scrolls but this exact work, the Zadokite fragment of Brit Damascus, the Damascus governments, which means that somehow the medieval copy in the Geniza showed that this was circulating in the Middle Ages, even though it's from the Dead Sea Scrolls. So what do the Karaites say? Ha! We told you. You see? There's continuity. The fly in the ointment is a report by the head of the Catholic, the Nestorian Church in Jerusalem around the year 800 about how some Jews had discovered some scrolls at the Dead Sea, had gone down there, picked them up, and brought them back to Jerusalem, and were copying them. So there is a theory that perhaps these scrolls, like the Damascus Covenants and other scrolls in the Dead Sea, found a way to Jerusalem and made an influence on early charism, and there's no organic relationship between Bayit Sheni and charism in the 9th century. The similarities have to do with this chance discovery of Dead Sea Scrolls 1,200 years ago. But you're very correct in saying that there are no literary remains between the Dead Sea Scrolls and Anan that would indicate that these groups remain. My personal opinion is that there are lots of non-rabbinic groups that existed after the destruction of the temple. We just don't know about it because they didn't write, and the Talmud wrote. But if you look at where the Karaites came from, besides Anan, who was part and parcel of the Gaonic establishment, you have most of the early Karaites were from Persia. Well, Persia was far away. The Abbasids in Iraq were trying to extend their control over the Persians. I mean, let's talk about these names today, Iraq and Iran. All right? They didn't like each other in the times of Nebuchadnezzar and Koresh. They didn't like each other in the times of the Parthians who came and captured Babylon during the Babylonian the Talmud was written. They didn't like each other when the Arabs invaded and turned them into Islam. They don't like each other today, as many of you know. All right? So these far-flung communities, it's not unlikely that the Gaonim in Iraq and Baghdad would send emissaries and say, you know, here's the Talmud, and this is the way we do things. And some of the people said, you know, what do you mean this is the way we do things? It's not the way we do things. And this caused a schism that was a recognized one. Up till then, there were different practices. We don't know about other diaspora Jewish groups. We don't know how the Jews in Rome in the 3rd century practiced their Judaism. We know a little bit about the Jews of Alexandria in the 1st century of the Common Era before that community was destroyed. We don't know a whole lot about it. So we can assume there are lots of non-rabbinic Judaisms somehow preserved one way or another. And then when the Talmud was accepted and the Babylonian Geonot, the Geonim in Babylonia, had full authority, when someone didn't like this authority, that caused a schism. Up till then, you know, you lived here, you lived there, and who, you know, no email, no internet, no planes, no trains. You know,
each had a minute for a question and answer.
Yeah. Are there any Karaitic communities in the Galat today?
Well, the center is in Daly City, California. Look at Karaite Judaism USA, where they call themselves. They have a website. There is about maybe about 2,500 Karaites in America, mostly around the Bay Area. There's a community in France and Switzerland and Istanbul. And in the Eastern European ones, some of whom were have suddenly discovered again that they're Jewish, prodded by emissaries of the Jewish agency who have a quota to fill in terms of immigrants to Israel. So there are diaspora communities. I'm really sorry I didn't bring with me, trying to not take too much from Israel, a calendar which has actually the list of all the communities in Israel and a list of the communities outside with addresses and phone numbers if you want to get in touch. But you look on the web, there are lots of Karaite sites. Some of them are not authentic Karaite sites, but there's the site that's from the community in America, and there is a site which says it's not the official community site in Israel, but seems to represent a lot of their views.